And this is The Naked Scientist with me, Ben Valsler, and with Kat Arney. Now, we've just heard that falling in love invokes a cocktail of quite poorly understood chemicals that cascade through your brain. But what happens once that initial rush has worn off? We are still joined by Alex Kogan and Hert ter Horst. So, Alex, how does a reaction to these chemicals change over time?
Great question. Poorly understood, I would say. You know, there's only a handful of studies that have really been done in terms of humans and studying love in terms of the scanner. I'm not really aware of much work in terms of oxytocin, looking at levels as they track. We do know that, you know, the course of love does peak in terms of the early phase, in terms of this manic, I want to be with you all the time phase, and then cools off. We go from this great state of passion to more companionate love as it rolls on, and it becomes more tender and more about connection and commitment. But the neuroscience were quite a ways from really understanding because of all the challenges that are involved in trying to study topics like this.
Gert, do you have any idea about how this rose-tinted vision that we have during what we call, quite rightly, the honeymoon period, how does that seem to affect the pathways in our brain?
How it affects our pathways, I don't know. But what we've done currently is we are measuring using pupil dilation to see how long this period actually lasts. And pupil dilation is a measure of our emotions. What we do is we show people a picture of their partner, and then we study them over time. And what we've seen that it probably lasts for something like 10 months.
Is that all? That does not seem like a very long time.
Hey, I'll take it.
And as sad as this may be to bring up, but what happens at the end of a relationship? Heartbreak can feel like a physical illness. It really hits you hard. Do we know what's going on chemically during that period?
What chemically is going on, I don't know. But we've just completed an MRI scan for approximately 100 people who've gone through breaking up of a relationship. And what we see is a big difference between men and women. In women, for example, we find a lot of inhibition in the brain when they are confronted with a photograph of their ex-partner, which is significantly less in men. What we also see is that women suffer greatly from heartbreak, really at the beginning, and after 6 months this wears off. And in men, we see the opposite. They start rather happy after a breakup, but they end up in a serious breakup problem after about 6 months.
Do you know how that also maps on to maybe the different roles of being the breakupper and the breakupee? Because you could imagine the person that's doing the breaking up initially feels relief. They're great. You know, I got out of this relationship I wasn't happy about. And they have that initial boom. And then later on, they realize, well, wait, there were all these wonderful things I had that are now gone. Whereas for the breakupee, they get hit with the misery right away, but maybe they could start the healing process a little earlier.
Yes, we also studied that aspect. But since we have not yet completed the study and we are running the final analysis right now, I cannot really discuss this yet.
Mm. Well, on a more positive note, do we know what changes occur that help people to stay together? Do we see particular patterns of brain activity in couples who've been together for a very long time?
I suppose there's some evidence from animal models where, again, the prairie voles, in terms of distribution of, say, the vasopressin network or the oxytocin network. So we could say those systems are likely involved, but the work with humans is early. You know, the first studies really with humans with oxytocin didn't really begin until the 2000s, I would say, and really picking up with nasal sprays. And so I think we're still really trying to figure out what happens in the moment, and we haven't really started to touch on a lot of these more interesting longitudinal effects.
It seems surprising to me that something that has concerned mankind for all eternity is something that we've only recently started studying.
It's funny you mention that because pre-1970s, there was really almost no research in psychology on love. Zick Rubin was one of the pioneers who started the work. And during his dissertation, they said, well, why are you studying this? Nobody's done it. He said, well, keep the lip review very short. And now it's much longer because there's been a lot more work done. But it's so complex. A lot of the work is often, well, we need to narrow the scope, not study love of everything, which will include cheesecake. But we'll study just the, you know, passionate love, which is a very particular type of romantic love, or companionate love, or unconditional love. And it's one of the most complex topics that we know of.
And we have to do longitudinal studies as well to follow people.
Yeah.
Because that has not been done yet.
Not at all.
And just quickly, Gert, we were talking about dopamine earlier. We know that dopamine, as well as being involved in reward, is very frequently involved in addiction. Do we think it's possible that long-term relationships may just be a case of being addicted to each other?
This has been studied in one MRI study in the U.S., where they showed that people who were still in love after 25 years and heavily in love, so they claimed they were as much in love as they when they just met, in these people, they have a pattern of brain activity that resembles addiction. So it could be.
So it really could be that we are just simply addicted to one another. I think that's quite a nice way to end. And, of course, Robert Palmer said that we're going to have to face it. We're addicted to love. That was Alex Kogan from Cambridge University and Gert ter Horst from the University of Groningen.